This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was Valerie Jarrett, former senior advisor to President Barack Obama. In fact, Valerie Jarrett was the longest-serving senior advisor to the president. She was there through both of his administrations. She oversaw the offices of public engagement and intergovernmental affairs and also chaired the White House Council on Women and Girls. She talked about President Obama's management style, which she described as being very thoughtful, very deliberate, and if he didn't agree with you, he would say, let's research that issue a little more. Prior to becoming President Obama's senior advisor, Ms. Jarrett served as the CEO of the Habitat Corporation, chairman of the CTA, commissioner of the City of Chicago Department of Planning and Development, deputy chief of staff to Mayor Richard M. Daley, and in fact, she hired Michelle Robinson, who would become Michelle Robinson Obama, as a young attorney in City Hall. She has just announced that she has been appointed to the Obama Foundation and also the Ariel Investment Corporation. When she talked about the greatest successes of the Obama administration, and she felt these came in health care and in bringing hundreds of thousands and millions of people under the health care insurance banner, getting the economy moving, getting the group to address climate change, and opening up new positions in government to diverse populations. Among the greatest failures, she said, was the lack of bipartisan support and the failure to give a hearing to Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland.
Just last week, she was appointed to the board of directors of Chicago-based Ariel Investments. A little point of information on that. Her father, Dr. James Bowman, was one of the original members of the Ariel Board of Directors. So the obvious first question is, what's it like to be in your father's seat?
Oh, boy. You're going to make me cry at the very beginning? First of all, good afternoon. I'm looking around this room. I think I know almost everybody here. There is no place like home, so thank you very much for welcoming me back here. Gave me a second to compose myself. It is an extraordinary honor. My dad was one of the original investors. Those of you who know John Rogers know that he started Ariel as a very young adult. I was one of the people who said, you're far too young to start this business. Similarly to me telling somebody else, you're far too young to run for president. So much for my advice. But my father believed in John and his mission, and not only is he an extraordinary business person, but he's also a great civic leader here around the United States and around the world, so I'm honored to join his board.
Thank you. So after you finished telling then U.S. Senator Barack Obama that he was too young to run for president, what did he say to you?
Well, the story goes back a little further. Where I gave him my most incorrect advice was when I suggested that he not run for U.S. Senate. And those of you from Chicago will know he had not that long before lost in the congressional race against Congressman Bobby Rush. And so I said, if you run so quickly, then if you lose again, your political career is over. And so I don't think that you should do it. And he said, well, I'm going to do it. And if I'm not afraid of losing, then why are you? Which was really actually very good, sound advice, that you've got to take risks. He thought his opportunity was right then, and so he decided to run. And so actually, by the time he decided to run for president, I was like, okay, all right. You're kind of young, but okay, let's try. And the rest is history.
How would you describe your experiences as an advisor to President Obama over the last 8 years?
Yeah, extraordinary. Best 8 years of my life to be able to be there from day one until the last day and have a chance to see our country come back from what could have been the worst economic crisis of a lifetime, and certainly was in my lifetime. Not since the Great Depression had we been right on the precipice with the banks in a free fall and losing 750,000 jobs a month, and to see us go from an unemployment rate down up to 10, down to less than 5, and 20 million people with health care, many who didn't have it before, and scaling down wars and figuring out how to grow and build the middle class. It was just an extraordinary experience, and there were some highs and there were some lows, but I wouldn't have traded it for anything.
What was it like on that first day when you and your the team moved into the White House complex?
It was just stunning, is all I can tell you. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. Before we moved in, I was one of the co-chairs of the president's transition team, and so we started working literally the day after the election, preparing for an orderly transition of power. And I always give President Bush a shout out and his team because they did everything possible to ensure that we could hit the ground running. They were cooperative. They volunteered as much information as possible. They really set the tone. And it says a lot, I think, about our democracy, where we really ran a campaign against many of his policies, and yet he knew it was his responsibility to help us. And the first time that I went to the White House as a part of the transition team, I went with Mike Strautmanis, who's here. Mike, put up your hand. Who's now with the Obama Foundation. And Mike was overseeing the reorganization or the staffing of the offices of public engagement and intergovernmental affairs. So we go into the White House together, and it's right before Christmas, and the decorations were up, and it was just at twilight, and we were walking up the grounds, and we were petrified, to say the least, excited, exhilarated, didn't know what we were going to encounter. And just as we went through the checkpoint at the Secret Service counter, we were, first of all, delighted they let us in, because who knows, that parking ticket you never paid or what might pop up. I was really more worried about Mike than myself. So we go through the gates, and we're walking up, and we're looking at the White House, and it's all lit up, and so exciting, and the cameramen who are on this place called Pebble Beach to the right of the White House, one of the cameramen, you'll remember this, Mike, yelled out, "Welcome to the White House." We burst into tears, both of us, I might add. We just stood there crying like babies. And so, I mean, if you had asked me growing up, what were the chances of I ever actually working in the White House and knowing or meeting the President of the United States, I would have been stunned. So that first day was overwhelming, to say the least. While the parade was going on in front of the White House, Mike and I were inside trying to figure out where the bathrooms were.
Had you ever been in the White House before that day?
I had been in there two other times. I was lucky enough to be invited as a guest when President Clinton was in the White House to an event. And then also my cousin Anne Marchant worked for President Clinton, and so I went to her goodbye party. But I had certainly not been around it the way we explored and discovered it over the 8 years we were there.
If that was the first day, what was it like on the last day when you and...
Did you hear that sigh? Oh, my God. Well, you know, I was determined to be there on the last day. I wanted to just finish out this entire journey. And people used to always joke and say, well, how did you last for 8 years? There isn't a single moment where in my wildest dreams it occurred to me to leave early. It's like, why would you leave early when you know you only come this way once? And so that last day obviously was bittersweet. And I went over early. And they have a tradition where they fly a flag on the first and the last day of an administration, and then the people who oversee the House, the White House, deliver the flag to the President and the First Lady. And so I watched that ceremony, and it was quite powerful and emotional, as you would imagine. And then I was there when President-elect Trump and Vice President Pence and their spouses arrived and the leadership, and they have a reception. And I think, again, it's an indication of how hard you have to work, no matter how you might feel about the outcome of an election, for a smooth and orderly transition. And we tried very hard to do for the same thing for the Trump transition team as President Bush did for us. But it was painful to see, for example, the House staff, who we'd all gotten to know on such personal terms, come down to say that final goodbye. So there were a lot of tears.
You have been described, Valerie, as President and Michelle Obama's first friend. What does that imply? What does that mean?
We're really good buddies, right? I mean, I've known them 26 years. I was telling the story last Friday about how I met them. Susan Schur, who's also here, was a corporation counsel, and she sent me a copy of a resume of Michelle Robinson when I was Mayor Daley's deputy chief of staff. And across the top, she wrote something like, outstanding young lawyer, not in the least bit interested in being in a law firm. No offense to everybody who's at law firms. Sorry about that. I'm sorry, Al. Sorry, Albert, I didn't see you. But I thought, my kind of person, because I wasn't too high on law firm life either, and interviewed her. I told about how, like, 10 minutes into the interview, I figured out I was no longer interviewing her. She was interviewing me. And I made her an offer on the spot. And then the next thing I'm saying to her, why have you not accepted the offer? And she said, well, my fiancé doesn't think it's such a great idea. And I'm like, well, what do you mean your fiancé doesn't think it's such a great idea? And she said, well, you know, he started as a community organizer. And what if he doesn't agree with something Mayor Daley does? Like, who's going to be the person looking out for me? Will you have dinner with the three of us? And so I said yes, and that was a really wise decision that I made. And an enlightening dinner.
I take it that dinner wasn't at Valois.
It wasn't at Valois, but it could have been.
Okay.
We all lived in the Hyde Park neighborhood. In fact, I think it's my mom's favorite restaurant in the neighborhood, she told me the other day. So, but it really was the beginning of what I know will be a lifelong friendship. And, you know, over the course of 26 years, they married, they had two amazing children. We were involved with each other both professionally and personally over the course of the normal vicissitudes of life. And out of that, you find out who you can trust. And I'm sure everyone in here who has a friend that you made friends with 26 years ago, you become pretty good friends.
Absolutely. Reflecting back at this experience, what do you think were the greatest successes of President Obama and his team?
That's easy. I think, number one, saving our economy. I mean, the fact that you now have millions and millions of people who have jobs who did not have them and who were at risk of losing them was very important. Righting the economy and putting rules of the road in place to ensure that the banks were not able to take risks with other people's money to that degree and get, in a sense, too big to fail again. We wanted to make sure that we didn't repeat that tragedy again. And so those rules are in place, and I hope they stay in place. I'm very proud of the work we did around the Affordable Care Act, and still to this day confused about how it turned into such a politically charged issue. What is wrong with wanting everybody to have affordable health care? I just don't get that. I'm on the international stage. I'm proud of the fact that we were able to strike a deal with a consortium of other countries to ensure that Iran doesn't develop nuclear weapons. Reestablishing relationships with Cuba, I think, is transformative. The fact that on the world stage, I think President Obama tried very hard to show that force isn't the only way that you solve big problems, that as complex as the world is, you really do need to use diplomacy. You shouldn't be afraid to use force, but you should also use diplomacy. And so I think our reputation improved on the world stage. Reduced our dependence on foreign oil. I mean, the amazing strides that we made for energy efficiency, one of the areas where I am concerned about policy going forward. We do have to recognize that the climate is changing, and the fact that, thank you, Alderman Moore, the fact that we were able to get nearly 200 countries to come together in Paris and sign an accord, all making commitments, not just government commitments, but private sector commitments too, and thanks to those of you in this room who support those efforts, because we do want to leave the environment better to our children and our grandchildren than we found it. So these are just a few of the many things that I'm very proud about.
And we're proud that you were part of that. How about the lack of success? What do you think rankled the president and someone like yourself the most?
Well, I'll give you three. First of all, I deeply regret that we were unable to get Congress to pass just the simplest of laws requiring universal background checks before we give people access to lethal weapons. I just think, why wouldn't you do that? And, you know, we focus a lot on the tragedy at Sandy Hook, and it was certainly my worst day during the president's time in office. We heard the news, and then just a couple days later went to Newtown and had participated in a memorial service for the 20 children and 6 adults who lost their lives so viciously. But soon thereafter, I came back home to Chicago with the First Lady and attended the funeral of Hydea Pendleton, who was murdered just a mile or so from where we live in North Kenwood, Oakland area, South Kenwood, Oakland. And, you know, so whether it's a mass tragedy or it's one daughter, we just can do better. And so that's one big disappointment. Another big disappointment was on comprehensive immigration reform. The president believes we are a nation of laws, but we're also a nation of immigrants. And, you know, part of why we are the beacon of hope to the world and people are drawn to the United States is that this is the land of opportunity. And we should have been able to get Congress, with the bipartisan support we had, to pass comprehensive immigration reform. It would have been a path to citizenship for many people who are in this country and who do contribute mightily to our economy and our quality of life, as well as providing opportunities for people who come here, enjoy our incredible institutions. We've got the best universities in the world. And what do? After they get their degree, we send them back home so that they can compete in another country. Well, why wouldn't we want to keep them here? Because those jobs just create more jobs. And then I suppose the final one is one that's disappointing to me because it was one of my responsibilities, and that was to try to get criminal justice reform legislation through Congress. And the goal there was to reduce mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent violent drug offenders. Our prisons and jails, as Chairman Preckwinkle could tell you, are full of people who either belong in facilities where they could get treatment for substance abuse or mental health challenges, or they deserve to have had a better education and they need a path to diversion. And we need to be investing in people when they are incarcerated. And finally, we need to be hiring them when they're released from prison and giving them that second chance so that they don't go through the revolving recidivism door. And the piece of that that we didn't get done was a piece that required congressional action. Again, where we have bipartisan support, and I tell this story that if anyone told me that I would spend the quantity of time that I did with the General Counsel of Koch Industries, I would say that couldn't be, but you know what? They were supportive of it, and we had Grover Norquist, very fiscally conservative academic on the right, and the ACLU on the left, and everyone in between, and still, Congress refused to act. But the good news there is that there is work going on all across the country, including right here in Cook County, the state of Illinois. Cities and states and counties are passing legislation, and the vast majority of people who are incarcerated are at the state and local level. 2.2 million people in our country are incarcerated in our prisons. 11 million cycle through our jails on an annual basis, and so there's a lot of very important work that can be done outside of the federal government.
Thank you. Could you describe President Obama's management and leadership style for us? And as a follow-up to that, did you ever tell him no about something? And what was his reaction?
Okay, I'll start with the first one. That was easier. So his his management style is, I think, first of all, takes the long view. And there were lots of decisions that he made as president that might not materialize and come to fruition for years on end. And I think part of the challenge when you're an elected official is that you tend to, by necessity, focus on the election cycle. And there are certain things that you can do right after you're elected that you can't do in an election year. And pretty soon you're finding your moment for really bold change gets limited. And he always managed to say, let's take the long view. There were people, for example, who encouraged him not to go forward with the Affordable Care Act. And they said, well, save that for later. It's going to erode your popularity. And his point was, well, what's the point of being popular unless you're going to do bold things? And this isn't a popularity contest. And he was prescient, really, because if you think about it, the legislation was contested twice where the lawsuits went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And so it was important that we had that runway because it takes a while to get it done. And really, I wish we'd had four more years to have it firmly a part of the fabric, and then it would be harder to unravel, although we're finding out it was hard to unravel anyway where we were, because it's a complicated piece of business. So he takes the long view. He's a very good listener, and many of you in this room know him. He's just intellectually curious. He has high emotional intelligence, and he gives you his undivided attention. And whether you were the most junior person in the room or you were his chief of staff, he always wanted to hear what people had to say. And he treated people like if you're working in the White House or you're in my cabinet or in my administration, I know Kelly Walsh is here, he would appreciate this having served in the Commerce Department, general counsel of the Commerce Department, that he wanted to know as much as he could before he made a decision, because the president's decisions are pretty important. And so you want to be informed, and you want to make intellectual decisions. And he used to joke with us, and he would say, "Why don't you all ever bring me some of the easy decisions?" No, we make those. That's what your staff does. You get the tough ones, the ones that keep you up at night. And so I think it's important to note that he was very, very inclusive in his decision-making process, and then he wasn't afraid to make a decision. And he didn't just admire the problem and enjoy the conversation. The whole point was to drive it to a conclusion so he could make a decision and then go on to the next one. And he was very patient in that process. And I mean patient, not necessarily patient necessarily with all of us, although he never lost his temper 8 years, and goodness knows, I'm sure we gave him reason to. But he always has that, you know, kind of even temper. But he was patient in that if he didn't have all the information he needed, he didn't make the decision. He would send us back and say, "I want you to answer these 5 more questions and then come back to me, and then I'll make it when I'm ready." And the other big strength, I think, is that he considered diversity a strength. And so he wanted to make sure he surrounded himself with a whole range of people who came from different perspectives than he did, so that he listened most closely to those with whom he disagreed. And I think that improved his decision-making as well.
Sounds like his style is very different than the current occupant of the White House.
Let me get to the other question that you asked me that I didn't answer, which was, what happens when I would say no? Well, first of all, you don't just say no. You say, "This is my opinion." And I think part, again, back to the management, is that people who were on his team felt so good about the process, the decision-making process, that in the end, when he made a decision, you often couldn't remember, "Well, where did I start on this? And did we end up in a different place?" Because it was one that was intended to get buy-in. And I think when you are running the country and you need so many people to implement your decisions, it's good to include them in the process along the way. Makes implementation a lot more smooth and easy.
You and your colleagues, Susan Scher and others, the other night you said in an interview that when you both worked for Mayor Richard M. Daley, that you were terrified.
Yes, we were.
Would you
I know Nora's here. I'm sorry, Nora. Well, you know what? Because he's the mayor of the city of Chicago, and we were still kind of young, and we were thrilled to have these incredible positions that he had given us. I mean, he believed in putting, you know, women in high-power positions. Was there ever a woman who was corporation counsel before Susan? I don't think so. And so we were really very happy to be there and thrilled to be there, and he scared us a bit. So it's true. It's true. But the story, to finish the story that Susan and I were telling, we told this in the context of us being in his office very early, soon after she was appointed corporation counsel. And at that point, I was the commissioner of planning and development. And we love to tell the story because it says so much about him. And it says so much about culture. And that is, we're sitting there and we're supposed to be paying attention to whatever the topic of the meeting was, and neither of us were paying any attention at all. And we kept looking at our watches, and so finally he said, "What is it that you all want to do that's more important than what we're doing right here?" And I looked at Susan, and we had this moment of truth, and I said to him, "The Halloween parade starts in 20 minutes. It's 25 minutes away." And we both held our breath, because who knows? We didn't know what he would say. And what he said is, "Then what are you doing here?" And the relief we felt to have our boss empower us, we were both single moms, and we knew if we didn't show up at the parade, there would not be a parent there. We go flying down Lakeshore Drive, 100 miles an hour, and I know, exactly. And we get up to the lab school just as these little darlings are coming out in their costumes, and you can see them looking through the crowd for us, and we were there. And we were there because Mayor Daley gave us permission to go. And not only gave us permission, but he and Maggie supported, leading by example, putting family first. And I think that model served well as we both worked in the White House to try to encourage our junior staff who had children to be sure to take care of your family and that you can, you know, you can be in a high-powered position but still be a really good parent.
So would you say...
Thank
And by the way, I understand Halloween was his favorite holiday.
So he got it.
Yep.
He got it. But even if it hadn't been Halloween, because what Susan said last Friday was that the best excuse in the world if you had to get out of a meeting with Mayor Daley is parent-teacher conference. We had lots of parent-teacher conferences.
It's the lab school. What do you expect? Okay.
He was great.
So there were so many women that he appointed to meaningful positions, and he obviously recognized talent and energy and creativity, yourself, Susan, we could name many others. The name Inga Fricklin comes quickly to my mind at this moment. So is Mayor Daley, would you say, a strong feminist?
Yes, I say that absolutely unequivocally. And I think he's raised his children to feel the same way, to feel like you can compete on an even playing field regardless of gender, and that you should be very mindful of supporting working families. And so, yes, I think he was. He was amazingly supportive of each of us.
Good. How close did you come when President Obama gave up his Senate seat?
I knew you were going there.
It's a city club, so, you know, we always like to probe and find certain things out. How close did you come to making a decision to strike out for that seat? And you were quoted as saying that the Obamas sort of dissuaded you. Could you talk to that,
yeah,
please?
Yeah, sure. Why not? It's just us, right?
Just 340 of your closest friends.
Yeah, and whoever's watching on TV. No, I mean, I haven't been asked about it that much, but Susan and I did talk about it again last week. And so I did think of very seriously about throwing my hat in the ring. And my family and my closest friends were all supportive of it. And they thought that it would be great to be a U.S. senator, be a legislator, be a principal, if you will, and do my own thing. So they were all for it. And what the president ultimately said is, look, I know you, I know the Senate, because I've been there, and I know what I want to build in the White House, and I think you will enjoy the executive branch more, and you'll feel as though your impact could be greater in the executive branch with me, with a portfolio that you described of issues that I had cared passionately about for a very long time, compared to joining the Senate. And boy, was he right. I'm very, very glad I didn't join the Senate. I think for those who did work in the Senate over the last 8 years or in the House, it's extremely frustrating. And there are so many people there who are putting their short-term political interests ahead of what I think is the greater good and what's good for our country. And so if you talk to our U.S. senators, they'll tell you it's really, really frustrating. And I think that they do an amazing job, and I'm glad that they're there fighting for us each and every day. But I think I made the right decision to be in the executive branch.
How frustrated, speaking of frustration, would you say that President Obama became over the Merrick Garland and the refusal to give him a Senate hearing?
Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd probably put it at about a 52. Because it's ridiculous. Look, he's elected for a four-year term. As far as I'm concerned, that four-year term ended January 20th of this year, not a year earlier. It's the first time in history where you've had a vacancy during an election year that wasn't filled. In fact, the last time there was a vacancy was for Justice Kennedy when he was nominated by President Reagan. I would mention that Vice President Biden was then chairman of the Judiciary Committee. The Democrats gave Justice, then Judge Kennedy, a hearing, and he was confirmed almost unanimously. I think unanimously. And so that's how it's supposed to go. You give a hearing to the president's nominee, you do it in public so that the American people can see for themselves how those questions are answered. If I were you, I would get some input from your constituents, and then you make your own judgment as to whether or not they're qualified to serve. But to simply say, because we're in an election year, we're going to strip the president of the power he has to make an appointment, it's unheard of. And not only is it unheard of, but then you ended up, as we did till now even, with a court that split 4-4. And we all know, this is a group of a lot of business and civic leaders, the certainty that the Supreme Court can give you by having a national law is important. You all don't like uncertainty. And so if you're operating in multiple states, you could imagine right now you could have different circuits coming to different conclusions, and then that's the law in those circuits until the Supreme Court makes the ultimate decision. So it's bad for business. It provides a lack of certainty to everyone. And it's not the reason why our democracy created the Supreme Court. So, yeah, pretty ticked off about that.
Okay. Take that to the bank. Okay.
And
yes,
I'm not done yet on this one. What I should have led with was is anybody I know that's ever been appointed to the Supreme Court with better qualifications. Here he's the Chief Judge of the D.C. Circuit. He served there 19 years. And in all of the time, I'm going to beat this dead horse, in all of the time that you heard his appointment being held up, I never heard a single Republican on the Judiciary Committee or in the Senate say he wasn't completely qualified for the job.
Absolutely.
All right,
well, speaking
I'm
of
done now
okay,
that
speaking of elective office, would you consider a run in the future for an elective office?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. That was very sweet. Thank you for that. No. You know, I think I'm at a different stage of my life. Now, you never say never, and I say this because I said I would never, ever work for the federal government, and then what did I do? I worked for the federal government. That was because I was very frustrated when you're here in local government, and you feel as though the federal government is so far away, and their programs are not tied to your reality. And part of what we try to do, and I see Derek here from the University of Chicago, when Derek was in the White House as well, we try to ensure that our programs were being tailored to the needs of the community. But I think I'm at a different phase of my life. I do want to continue to be a force for good. We just made public today that I'm signed on to be a pro bono advisor to the Obama Foundation, and I'm very interested in what it can do. It's not my day job, but it is something I'm very passionate about. I think that the President and the First Lady and their team, including Mike Strautmanis and others who may be here, are committed to making it not only a beacon of hope and an engine, an economic engine in Chicago on the South Side, where South Side, great side of Chicago, but for the country and the world. And they are less interested in the library part of it than they are in the center, in the foundation, which is not looking to the past and all that he did as president, which is important and educational and historic, but to the future. And how can these two extraordinarily talented people who are still very young have an impact and use that as the epicenter for how they develop a platform for engagement with all of you and many, many more to solve some of the big problems that are left unsolved here in our nation and around the world. So that's going to take up a good bit of my time, and I'm just passionate about it, and we invite everybody here to participate. It's something that civic engagement is something that you don't get hired to do. Hopefully it's something that you're born recognizing it's your responsibility to do as a citizen.
Well, I think we all appreciate your commitment to that. And remember, Mike, she said it's not her day job. Okay.
It's not my full-time job, is what I said. But I'm looking forward to working with Mike. He's terrific and has made a big impact just since he arrived back home in Chicago. So we've got lots of big things to do together.
Many of us were impressed with the president's wife, with Michelle's activities during the last presidential campaign. Do you think she could be a candidate to run for public office in the future?
I think it's safe in saying no. I think that she considered being the First Lady of the United States, also an unpaid job, I might add, but where you work really hard, a great platform to be a force for good, and whether it was her efforts around Let's Move to reduce childhood obesity or the work that she and Dr. Biden did with our military families to help support them, or her Reach Higher, helping young people aspire to go to college. And now a big piece of her last year was focused on Let Girls Learn. There are 100 million girls around the world, adolescent girls, who are not in school. And we know staying in school is the best indicator of economic success in life. And so all these issues that she focused her time and attention were where she felt passionately about the subject and where she thought she could help move the needle. And that work will continue. Both of them will sort through what are the issues that they really want to devote the rest of their lives to. And as I said earlier, that will really be focused in their Obama Center. And I think that's where her work will occur. I don't think she'll be running for office. I know.
One of the questions that was submitted to us, Democratic voters and activists have watched as the Senate the House of Representatives and the presidency have slipped away to the Republican Party. What do you think it will take to right what appears to many to be a sinking ship?
That's an interesting question. Well, I don't think our ship is sinking. I mean, in fact, I'm still very optimistic about our country, and part of it is that I now get to spend so much time outside of Washington, and when you do, you see the amazing transformation happening across our country on a whole host of different metric points. And I think that what it's going to take is, for example, the 43% of the people who didn't vote in the last election getting engaged. And I don't just mean when there's a presidential election. It's really important who your alderman is, who is on the county board, and who the mayor is, and who the governor and the state legislature is. One of the areas where Eric Holder, the former attorney general, is spending time, and President Obama will help him, is on this whole issue of redistricting. We've gerrymandered our lines in such a way that the American people aren't getting their fair voice. And so I think my optimism comes from the opportunity and the potential for civic engagement. And when the American people decide that they want to get involved and elect people who they think represent them and come and turn out to vote, then that's when things will change. And I'm hoping that that happens soon. And we want to create, I think, part of what President Obama, I have to keep saying President Obama now because it's confusing. There are lots of presidents. So I think what President Obama is really interested in is, one of the things he's very interested in is creating a mechanism by which young people can find out the best practices to run for office. I meet people across the country who are interested, but they don't know where to begin. They want to get civically involved, but how do you do that? And so teaching civic engagement and teaching community organizing in the way that he started his career, I think, is a way for us to pull into the Obama Center not just people in the United States, but around the world, who are the young leaders and who are the ones that we should all be nurturing and encouraging to run for office, and then supporting them when they do. We need a bench. We need a strong bench. And I think as a party, the Democratic Party doesn't have the bench that we should have.
So you got to build that farm system.
Got to build a farm
system.
Okay.
A couple last questions here. This is from Charlie Gardner, trustee at Roosevelt University. He'd like to know what changes should
be. Charlie. I didn't see you.
Jazz.
Hey, Charlie.
He's hiding behind
I
his
see him.
Wife. Okay. What changes should be made to improve Obamacare, and is there any chance of a bipartisan group emerging to make those changes?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. I have no idea because of the toxicity in Washington. I think if there were a will to do it, they could certainly do it. I think that they should move away from this whole repeal, which is just a political win that they're looking for. Because when you say repeal, keep in mind, it's not just the 20 million people who have health insurance through the exchanges. It's the people who benefited from the expansion of Medicaid and 39 of our states. It's the people who benefited from knowing that insurance companies can no longer discriminate against them if they have pre-existing conditions. And, you know, at my age, most of us have some sort of a pre-existing condition. Looking around this room, your age too. So
I'm only
hanging
out there
by
myself, here.
Right. But, or your children. I mean, I've met moms before the ACA was passed who's worrying about whether or not they could afford to get their children the treatment, or women who can now go in for preventive care without a copay. We always tend to put ourselves last, and now there's no excuse. You can go in and get that annual checkup, and you don't have to worry about lifetime or annual caps. And so there's a lot to the ACA that didn't get the attention that I thought it deserved, that if you say, let's repeal it, I would say to you why. So the question then that you posed is, so what do you do to improve it? We need to make the exchanges healthier. And so part of what would have helped is if the Republicans had helped us market to younger people, because as you in the insurance industry, and Frank Clark was just telling me he's on the Aetna board, know, you want to have a reasonably healthy pool, because then that makes the numbers work. And young people think that they will live forever, and it's hard to get them to buy insurance. And so marketing it better and getting a better mix of the pool would have helped. Perhaps we should have had more of a subsidy to encourage people to participate and encourage and help help the insurance companies until the pool was healthy enough that they weren't pulling out of some of the markets. We did see insurance companies pull out of markets because in the short run they were losing money, and in order to keep them there for the long run, it might have required a deeper subsidy. So I think that there are ways in which the ACA could be improved, and I think if Congress wanted to have a sensible conversation on the merits, they could come up with solutions. I did not think the plan that was proposed by the Republicans that would have dumped 24 million people over 10 years off of the insurance plans was a good solution. But there certainly could be ones that would work.
Thank you. This is from Tom McElroy. Tom, where are you?
All the way in the back.
Wherever, way in the back. Okay, that's good. He wants to know all the work that your team did to structure a smooth transition. It appears that the current administration has ignored that or chose not to act. How do you really feel?
Thanks, Tom. Look, our job, and I mean this most sincerely, our job was to do the very best job we could preparing as many transition both documents and in-person meetings as possible so that they had the benefit of what we learned over 8 years. Then it's up to them to choose how to go forward. I mean, elections matter. They have consequences. And I can't tell you that we accepted everything that President Bush's team told us. We didn't. Each new administration is free to make their own decisions. And so all I can comment on was what my job was, and that was to work very hard. We learned a lot over 8 years. We tried to distill it and put it in an intelligent form, and then you transfer it over like a baton, and then it's up to them.
There are a couple questions that we had, but we won't have time, but I'm just curious. The girls, Sasha and Malia, they seem to be two incredible people.
They're terrific.
Which is a real positive for whatever Michelle and the president
did. It's a tribute to their parents.
Absolutely.
And their hard work, too.
And Mrs. Robinson.
A gem.
What was she like?
She's wonderful. She's wonderful. And I think if you were to ask the president and first lady what truly made a difference, Susan's nodding, who was first lady's chief of staff for a period early on, it was having your – there's nothing like having your mom right there helping out where when you are living in this completely different world than the world that we lived in Chicago. And I mean, look, I was a single mom, and I know I couldn't have made it without the help from my parents. And so having her there, having that continuity, having another adult there, if the two of them had to be out of town, knowing that there was someone that the girls loved deeply and sincerely, who only had their best interest at heart, right there, living under their roof, was absolutely essential and made a huge difference.
We didn't even ask about the dogs. Two dogs.
Bunny and so, and well, Bo and Sunny are just precious, adorable. Somebody asked me, were the president and first lady taking their dogs with them when they left the White House? I'm like, you obviously don't have dogs. Of course they're taking their dogs with them.
Absolutely. Valerie, is there a book in the future?
Yes, I hope so. I just have to determine if I have the discipline to write it. But yeah, I have a lot to say. I really do, as you can tell, since I've talked nonstop.
Well, when you do write it, of course.
So I might. I come back here.
You're going to come back here?
I
we'll
might
sell
just,
the book?
I might just do that.
We'd like
particularly
to
if you're going to help me sell the book.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.